chapter 10 in Proverbs, and it is verse 20. And the verse says, "Pure silver is the tongue of the righteous, and the heart of the wicked is silver." Now, of course, pure silver is a metaphor here. It doesn't mean that the tongue of the righteous is made out of silver. It means that it's a metaphor, somehow a metaphor. Okay. It is small. I mean, yeah, it's a good question. We have to deal with is what is the pure silver? I mean, what's the metaphor? We have to interpret that, or not we no place. Pure silver. There's no such thing. When you mine silver, there's no such thing as pure silver. Every silver must be purified before it can become pure silver. It must be purified. We separate the dross from the silver until we get the pure silver. Silver and not other precious metals like gold or some other type of good like gold, okay? So what's the difference? Why do they use silver? Gold, it seems to be that you could actually find it pure, but silver is never found pure, and therefore silver you have to refine. And so therefore they use the metaphor of silver because of the nature of the metal. As far as the tongue of the righteous, what would be the pure tongue, and what would be the dross? And what would be the dross? Okay, so that's what we have to find out. And then, of course, we'd have to ask how to purify it. The silver represents truth. And we're asking the question, so therefore, the impure silver, in other words, the dross, so what does it mean that truth is mixed with dross? What does that mean? Truth is that which can be proven or demonstrated. Okay, that's what truth is. The dross. If we're going to follow through on the metaphor, when you mine silver, you have silver with dross. Now you're going to have to explain to me how has truth and falsehood mixed together. Here is dealing with the how the mind works. It's not how much knowledge I have. Well, it's not how much I have to prove it, but it's how clear the mind works. Okay? Now, the natural mind sees reality. But when it sees reality, there's a certain vagueness. Now, let's put it this way, there's dross mixed in. In other words, you see reality, you see truths, but however, it's not 100% clear because the mind is not totally developed. You see? And since the mind is not totally developed, so you see reality, and yet simultaneously mixed with that reality is dross, namely, it's not a clear picture. You see? What the righteous have done is that they've separated the dross so that the mind works correctly. You see? And the heart of the wicked is small, means it sees only small reality because there's too much dross mixed in with it. You see what I mean?
You're calling the mind and the heart.
In modern times, the heart usually means emotions, but in ancient times, it seems like the heart meant the mind. That has removed the dross from his thinking, okay? While the wicked has not dealt with it, so therefore, it's small. What it means small is that he sees certain truths. But however, it's mixed with a lot of dross and a lot of other ideas, and it's said many times even what he sees as true gets lost in with all the dross, you see? Because he has reality, he sees reality, so he has a certain truth there. But since the mind was not trained, you see, and removed the dross from the mind, so therefore, see, when you remove the dross, so then you think clearly, and every step is there. You know exactly what you're looking for. And that's the way you do not make mistakes. The thinking process, it's represented by the thinking process. So therefore, we're not dealing with what it actually says. It's really explaining how the mind works. In other words, when we see reality, when we see truth, so it's a vague picture. It's not clear because we haven't undone all the dross of the mind. So we make mistakes, okay? And we make mistakes in our logic and we don't notice it. We take a step and we think it's a correct step and we don't notice that we made a mistake. And then even if we ask a question, so then we clarify, but the mind still has to be cleared itself, okay? It's basically an idea that I heard from Rabbi Chait that he gave over many years ago. And the first question that we have to ask is how do you undo if you're thinking incorrectly and you make mistakes? So then the question is, how do you undo the mistakes? How do you change the mistakes? Like, let's say, for instance, you make a statement. And then I question you, and you see the question, you say, yeah, that's a good question. I made a mistake. So therefore, I have to change, and you move on in the discussion, moving in a different area. Like always, whenever we have a discussion, we have questions, and the questions say, this possibility is not good, so we have to move on to a different one. Sometimes we make an error in the way we formulate it, so we correct the formulation or whatever. But however, you'll notice that you keep making the mistake. Sometimes that is enough to correct it, but sometimes you'll find that you keep coming back and making the same mistake. Okay? Now, the thing is that the ancient thinkers said that there's one way of purifying the mind, and that is through the study of logic. Okay? Through the study of logic itself. Okay? Like, for instance, we have a book written, about a logic book written by our own sages and by other peoples. So the thing is, there are books on logics. Now the question is, as Rabbi Chait asked the question, let's assume that is correct, that the only way to purify the mind is through the study of logic. Question is what purifies the mind? In other words, like this. My mind is studying logic, but my mind is impure. So the thing is, when it's impure, it's the impure mind. What is the, in other words, let's put it this way. The eyes can't see itself. The ears can't hear itself, you see? You cannot, it's impossible for you to turn on yourself, you see? So the mind can't, well, how does it cure? And in other words, it's the mind, that's the very mind that's studying logic. So the question is, how do you cure the mind? You see? Now, when you study logic, you'll find, as you study logic, you will find that when you're discussing an idea like we are now, right? So we're discussing a particular subject, and the logic of the mind is working on this subject, okay? So therefore, when it's working on the subject, so then even if you have a question in the subject, you will not be cured. It will not be purified. But however, if I would point out the logic, you would immediately see that that's impossible. You would see it. There's no way that you're going to make a mistake once the logic is shown to you. Okay? Now, the reason for that is because logic is within the human being. If you didn't have logic, so then you would never be able to think. I mean, how can we even talk to each other? Well, we have a basic foundation, like the verse says, that the heart of the wicked is small. It means that they also have reality. Everybody has the mind. Everybody knows that there's cause and effect. But the only difference between, let's say, a scientist and a regular person says, well, you don't have a scarf on, that's why you caught a cold. Well, scientist says, no, it has to do with germs and different things. You know what I mean? He's more precise, and he analyzes it more. But we all have the mind. We all have cause and effect in our mind. You see? I present the logical idea where you made the mistake. It is so clear, you say, absolutely, it's impossible. You see it immediately. Now, what he wants to say, because of the question, how does the mind cure itself, he wants to say that there is a part of the mind. He gave it a name, discerning factor, okay? That's what he called it. He says that as soon as you put it to that third part of the mind, that is the one that decides that it's right. In other words, it just decides that the thing is right. you're dealing with a particular thing. When you're dealing with a particular thing, that is logic working. You say your mind is working. The logic is working. But when you go back to logic itself, then since there is no proof of logic, you can't prove it. Either the mind works this way or the mind doesn't. And automatically you know it. So he says there's a third part of the mind that decides that this is correct. Because of his original question that the mind can't cure itself, therefore there must be something else there that only relates to logic. And when you put the logic to that thing, so then it is, then that's what purifies the mind. But it must come in front of this thing that he calls the discerning factor. So therefore, when the discerning factor decides that this is logic, that helps cure the mind. But that could only operate, the discerning factor could only operate when you place in front of it pure logic. But if you place in it the subject itself, then that's the mind working. That's not the discerning factor. It's an incorrect idea in logic. The discerning factor won't correct your mind. You have the wrong idea. Your mind won't be corrected. People make mistakes, right? People make mistakes, and they study, and they make mistakes, then they correct themselves, and then they make mistakes again and correct themselves and constantly around. Now, however, but the great thinkers say that you could clear the mind through the study of logic itself, that the mind is cleared. In other words, that you will not make mistakes.
As many.
What?
As many.
No, you will not make mistakes. It can reach a point where you will not make mistakes. Okay? The question over here that we're dealing with now is that they say that it's impossible for a human being to have such perfection of the mind where the mind will not make a mistake. Okay, that's the question that we're dealing with. True, if you look around you, in the world around you, it is true, you will find that it is most people are like that they make mistakes, and you, even if they're honest, then you correct them, and they'll correct their mistakes, that they'll still be honest, it is true, but they'll continually make mistakes, that's true. But however, we're talking about the rare few thinkers that spent their life in study, and they also studied the ideas of logic. And what they say, what these people say, that is that it purified their mind that they don't make mistakes, or much less mistakes. I mean, but it is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand you buy that, but the only thing is that since they made less mistakes, it is possible to undo all. Why should you say it's not possible? There are people that undid all. Now they say that the only thing that did this is the study of logic. Now therefore, I never did this, so therefore I have to trust these people, right? These are the great thinkers. I'm accepting this as a fact. I'm assuming that all of them say it, that studied logic, and that they're telling the truth. These are our thinkers, the thinkers of the world. And they say that this is true. The only thing is the question that we ask is how does it work? How does it work since nothing could cure itself? How does the mind cure itself? Because the very mind that you're curing is the thing that's studying the logic. Mm-hmm. That was the question. So therefore, Rabbi Chait said that there must be another part of the mind that discerns that when you put the logic in front of it, so it says yes, and that corrects the mind. Now, once the mind is correct, then it will not make mistakes. Can get better. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Do you agree that the way a person gets better in his mind is through the study of logic? That you do.
Yeah.
Now, why do you say it can only get better and can't get it 100% correct? What stops you?
Because
the person can never get his mind perfect.
Right.
I mean, that it will not make mistakes. On what basis do you say that? Since you agree that the mind can correct itself. Now, why should it ever be stopped? That there should be a certain point where it corrected every mistake that it has. And now it thinks correctly. Why isn't that possible? Once you accept the idea that you can cure the mind, why do you go halfway? That did not thoroughly study logic, then that's no proof. We have to go back only to the people. The proof can only come from the people that actually studied logic. Now, if all the people that studied logic okay, as we understand it. So then, and they say that they that their mind was purified, so then we could accept that fact. Why, those are the people that you have to interview, not the regular person on the street. The regular person on the street never learned logic. Thinking does not purify the mind. What they say, what the ancients say, is that the study of logic purifies the mind. Now, once the mind can be purified, then it can be purified all the way.
Well,
you could study five different subjects, but it's only the mind that's working on each subject. Only the mind that works. Now, if the mind makes a mistake in a certain area, then whenever it comes to that type of maneuver, doesn't matter what the subject is, it'll make a mistake. But if that maneuver is purified, so then once that maneuver is purified, so then the once the maneuver is purified, so then you won't make any mistakes anymore in that area. Causes you to make a mistake. One is the mind doesn't work perfectly. It's mixed with the dross. That's the way every human being starts out. It's not a clear. The second thing, there are emotions which affect your thinking process. That's what we've been discussing all along, where emotions affect your thinking process. But this verse is not talking how the emotions affect your thinking process, but that the natural mind makes mistakes when it first comes into existence. And that you need logic to separate that, so you must correct two things. You must correct your knowledge, make sure you think correctly, and then two, you must also deal with your emotions so that it shouldn't affect your thinking process. Two separate things that you must clarify before you become the perfect thinker. Now, of course, to have the perfect person, that's very, very, very few people in the whole wide world. I mean, even in the Bible, the biblical sages, the biblical, you know, greats made mistakes, and sometimes they never corrected it throughout their lives. Some of them did. It seems to be that they actually operated without making any mistakes. But the thing is that's a very rare person. What I'm saying is that it is humanly possible to do that. How far we could go, each individual, we have to go as far as we could go. And that's all, just get on the road to doing the right thing. How far you go, that's each individual is different. But I'm not saying that every person is going to make it, you know, 100%. I'm just saying it is possible to make it 100% in these two areas. But they need two different things. One is logic. And the other is dealing with the emotions itself. Second half of the verse, we're saying that the person that has not done this, that has not worked through these ideas and purified his mind, so then that person will see a certain level of reality. Every human being has a mind, and they see truth to a certain extent, a very small, but it's very small, and it's very, you know, it's very small that how much they see. And it's mixed with all the draw, so it's not very, very clear. Talking about the way we're interpreting the verse is not talking about emotions at all. Perfection, you see. It's true, we cannot have the perfection of God. But neither can we. Let's say, for instance, if we run. We know running has a certain perfection. There's certain people that can run a four-minute mile or less. But even if he can, he can never outbeat some animal. There's many animals that run much faster than him. So insofar as what he's perfecting, in other words, what we're trying to find when we see how fast the person could run, so we're seeing the ultimate in human being, how fast the human being could go, or even lifting weights. There's a person that lifts his own weight, so that's a great person. But there are ants that carry 30, 40 times their weight, and they carry it for miles, not just for 1 second. So the thing is that insofar as human being is concerned, there's a certain definition of what is their perfection. Now, when we talk about insofar as the thinking correctly perfection, we think of the mind thinking correctly, plus that it has no outside interference like unconscious emotions that are affecting its thoughts. You see? So the thing is that is the highest level. Again, that's a rare, rare person that will do that, just like there's a rare person that will have the four-minute mile. But just because I cannot have the four-minute mile doesn't mean I can't run and jog and get how far I could go and enjoy that, what I could do. So the same thing with the world of ideas. We have the picture of the perfect, of the rare person, so that I know in what direction I'm going and how to get there. But I have to have that in mind. I have to have that picture in mind so I know where I'm going, even though I might not ever be able to get there. Probably very few people could get there. But at least I know the direction in which I'm going, you see. Now, the rare person defines the outer limits of the human, just like the one that runs a four-minute mile defines the outer limits of the human so that I know what direction I'm going. That gives me direction. But whether I could make it or not, that's a separate story. That depends on what my abilities are. If I don't have the ability, so then I'll just go a certain amount and I'll enjoy that amount. How far I can go, and if I could go further, then I'll go further. So that's all we're talking about. We're not talking, you understand, that when we talk about a human being, we're saying that the human being, insofar as perfection is concerned, we have to take the ultimate person and define him to know in which direction, but then know that you can't get there. A rare person that has perfected his thinking, that his logic will not make a mistake, and he has undid his emotions, where there is no emotion that will affect his thinking process. That person is a rarity. You could probably count them on the fingers of your hand. Maybe one hand, maybe two hands, I don't know. But the thing is, that's a rarity that you find such a person. But he defines what is the ultimate perfection of the human being. But that just gives me direction in which to look and to guide myself, not as a goal. Not as a goal. I mean, it just shows me the direction in which I should go so that I get closer and closer. But via these methods, gets me closer to God. Because as we get correct knowledge and as we undo our emotions, we're able to see correctly and we get closer and closer to God. These are the tools that bring us closer to God. Mind that studies physics. There's one mind that studies math. It's the same mind that studies the Torah. It's the same mind that studies chemistry. Whatever subject you study, there's one mind, okay? Mm-hmm. And that mind, when it thinks one way, and it approaches every subject. The subject changes how you're going to study it by virtue of the subject. But insofar as the mind is concerned, the mind, there's certain logical basic principles of logic, the way the mind works. By the way, by logic, basically, we're talking about Aristotle's approach. Okay? Yeah. Subject matter, we're only talking about the structure of the mind, nothing else. Yeah. That is Aristotle's logic. He defines the way the natural mind works. Okay? That's Aristotle's logic. It's not like modern logic, like mathematical logic, which is a different thing. That's the subject. The subject is, how do I do, should I do a certain act or not? That's the subject. That is not the mind.
So you're saying you can make it.
The mind works logically. And when you're thinking, what it's working along is along a certain way. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, I'll go into a class that never studied before, and I'll set up a problem, and I'll give a certain answer. And you'll notice the class starts asking questions, and you see the questions are right on line. They were never trained to think. And they ask tremendous questions. How is that possible? The answer is that the natural mind works in a certain way. That's what Aristotle was trying to prove, how the mind works. That, now, when you think, it is that mind which is analyzing the subject. It is that mind which is analyzing the subject. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, the thing is, if that mind makes a mistake in a certain area, so every time you come in that type of thought, the mind will make that mistake. Now, it could be corrected. Somebody will ask you a question, so you'll correct yourself. But you'll still come back and make the mistake again. The only way to cure it, to purify it, is when you study logic itself. Okay? Now, there's a finite amount of parts to logic. So, therefore, once you purify all the parts full of logic, so then you just won't make a mistake based on logic. One, the lips of the righteous feed many, and the fools, because they lack heart, they die. Lack a thought.
Okay.
This way, then fools die for lack of wisdom. Chapter 10, verse 21, and the verses is that the lips of the righteous feed many. because of lack of wisdom, they die. When it says feed the many, does it mean literally that it gives somehow the lips of the righteous somehow gives food to many people? Or is feed a metaphor? That's the first question. Die for lack of wisdom. What is the meaning of the term death? Is it physical or spiritual? Why does it say the lips of the righteous? And the lips of the righteous means that they converse with others. In other words, that's why it says that he feeds the many, however it works. But the thing is that he's conversing with others. And but the question is that we're asking is what type of conversation are we having? What type of conversing? What type of discussion are they having? How we want to answer it is like this: is that what the lips of the righteous, we always know that the righteous speak wisdom, and especially the second half talks about the fool that lacks wisdom. So definitely from the lips of the righteous definitely will come wisdom. Okay? Now once there is wisdom, from the lips of the righteous will come wisdom, then those people that listen to him will gain wisdom. Now, it doesn't say whether the wisdom is just general ideas from discussions and simply ideas. That's one way you could gain wisdom. And then as you have that wisdom, you could apply it to your life. Or he gives you the wisdom of the very problem that you're dealing with, the practical problem. It could be either way. The verse doesn't say which way. But either way would benefit the listener, whoever listens to it. In that way, he supports, by feeding it means he supports many, either by the practical advice that he would give a person or by educating people, so then they would get food. Okay, they would get their needs or whatever they want, their needs. They would satisfy their needs. Of course, in these two ways he would help them. It means to satisfy their needs. All their needs, to satisfy their needs. He satisfied many by giving many people ideas. Okay? Clear? Fool, when he talks and he gives advice, it's based on lack of knowledge. He just gives advice, but he doesn't look at it. In other words, he looks at life superficially, and he doesn't look to the ideas and the concepts and the depth and the clarity. He just takes things superficially. So therefore, it is really not a clear idea when he gives advice, so he doesn't give clear ideas. And many times, because of the superficiality, it's absolutely wrong. And people, once they make mistakes, you see, that affects them. In other words, death is the highest level of an error. There are many, many errors. Death represents that if I die before my time, if a person dies before their time, so that shows that there was something wrong. Now, the thing is that we know that, that first of all, practically, you could ruin yourself. Second of all, we know that conflicts cause to shorten a person's life, to bring them down. There's many, many different things. And if you have wrong ideas, incorrect ideas, definitely you're going to have terrible conflicts and you're going to make mistakes practically. There's many, many different problems, you see. So because of that, definitely it will reach the highest. In other words, it's very possible that if you take the wrong ideas, it could kill you. If you take the wrong advice, it can kill you. But definitely death represents the highest level of... There are two possible subjects here. Either the subject is rulers, and that there are two possible kinds of rulers. One that rules from wisdom, and therefore he'll benefit his people. And there is a leader that is superficial in his investigations and understanding, or he's not guided by wisdom. So that type of leader will destroy his nation. That's one type of possibility. There is another possibility that we're looking at the point of view from the person that's learning or taking advice, and the verse is talking about whom should you choose to lead you. In other words, when you want to look for a leader, if you had the choice, assuming in a situation where you have a choice, or a teacher, you see, then how do you choose? You see? So then the verse would say that in other words, that if you have two possible leaders, then you should choose that with wisdom, because he will benefit you practically. In a very practical manner, he will benefit you. While if you have an incorrect leader, then he will harm you, very definitely harm you, if he has incorrect advice. To say practically, we're telling a person how to choose a leader. Stop and think about it. You must stop to think about it, and you must see if the person has wisdom, some type of wisdom, to help you, that is going to give you advice or guide you or teach you, that to make sure you're getting the correct advice. And if you take a person that's going, let's take a lawyer. You go to a lawyer. You know, you go to a good lawyer, he'll give you advice, you'll be okay, you won't have problems. You go to an incompetent lawyer, by the time you get through, you have double the trouble than you started with. Be with a psychiatrist. You go to a good psychiatrist, he can help you. You go to a bad psychiatrist, people come out worse than when they went in. 22. The blessing of God will make you wealthy, and it will not add sadness with it, sorrow with it.
First question is, what is the blessing of God? Question would be, how does the blessing of God make you wealthy?
Okay,
and the next question is, why is the second phrase there, the phrase, and it will not add sorrow with it? What does that mean? What is the purpose of that? And then a fourth question might be, since previous proverbs have had opposites, there doesn't appear to be an opposite here, so what is an opposite of this?
Whenever we analyze a verse, we always have opposites. Here we don't have the opposite, so we can put in the opposite to help us do the analysis. Question is, what would be the opposite here? It just isn't any opposite, or maybe there's just one statement. I mean, that's also possible. If we have two opposites, then we'd be in trouble. You know what I mean? We'd either have to have two interpretations. We'd have to have two interpretations, or remove one of them, which would be best, so that we have a clear cut that there can only be one opposite. Then we could start on interpretation. That would be better. If a person becomes wealthy, not via the blessing of God, so then he would have wealth, but he would have sadness with it.
Possibility is that we could have wealth without the blessing of God, and also not have sorrow or sadness with it. Or if that is impossible, then we probably need to somehow show that that's impossible.
Analysis, that with God's blessing, if you have wealth with God's blessing, then you will not have sadness with it. If you have wealth without God's blessing, then you will have sadness with it. Okay? We'll take those two opposites. Now, to prove the second half, okay, that will wait for later till we do an analysis on all this and then see if it fits in. Okay? I have an interesting approach, and that is this. The physical world really doesn't know you. You know, and in that sense, like for instance, if you happen to be swimming and there's a tide, the tide doesn't know you, who you are. It just happens to be going out. If you happen to be there, it'll take you out. Okay? Now, the same thing with making money. Okay? The world, the physical world, or the interaction with people, I mean, in other words, there's a certain system of making money, and you have to work the game. And the thing is that sometimes, as you know, that it doesn't come easy. There are a lot of different problems that come alongside problems, this and that. In other words, you have a plan to make money. Then there's something comes in the way, a recession. I mean, out of the blue. You have no control over it. It doesn't know you. The recession is not out to get you. It's just a recession. Right? It's not whether, you know, it has nothing to do with you. It's a recession. It has to do, or some other thing happens out of the blue. I mean, Your boss loses money, or your boss, you know, whatever it is, and suddenly you're in trouble. Or a guy could choose between you and another person, and somehow he likes the way the other guy's tie was, or something drew him to him. It has nothing to do with you. It's just that, right, so whether you're going to make money, so you have to go through all these complications again and again and work it through. But however, there are certain people that are on a, that, now that is the laws of nature. However, there is such a thing called divine providence. Divine providence means that somehow, I don't know how it works, but somehow the physical world relates to you personally based on your relationship to God. Okay? That's divine providence. In other words, like the illustration that they give is if a righteous person is walking in a woods, and there's a hungry lion coming to meet him, right? And God wants to protect him, so divine providence will cause a deer to walk in the way of the tiger, which will satisfy him and keep him busy while the tiger goes on his merry way. Okay?
What?
No, that must happen. Divine providence means that you do not deserve to be harmed by that lion, and therefore we take in consideration who you are. In other words, the laws of nature will take in consideration who you are, and therefore it will operate in a certain way. That's called divine providence. How it works, how God, how the whole thing works, I'm not talking. I don't know. But the thing is, all I'm saying is that it's guided by God. Of course, it's a system created by God. But however, somehow, the physical world does, or God causes the physical world, however you want to put it, does relate to you who exactly who you are, if you are on the level. Okay? So, therefore, if you are on the level, so by the blessings of God, the commentaries say, we're talking about divine providence. So therefore, now for instance, so when you, if a person that is on divine providence goes out to business, and he has to do business, he can't just sit back and say, well, let the world come to me. He can't do that. He has to go out and do business. But what will happen, he'll have none of the side problems to make the money. He won't have all the little problems that come along, the recession somehow, even if it does come, will not affect him, or somehow he will be successful. And every factor fits into place for him, so he doesn't have any of the normal failures that a person must have until he makes his money. You see? So therefore, what the commentaries say, that the blessing of God means it's divine providence. And when he gets wealthy with divine providence, the method of getting wealthy is such that he will not have any problems doing it. However, if you do it in the laws of nature, then there's a tremendous amount of problems. Now, what you ask, is it possible for a person that even though he doesn't have the blessings of God, is it possible for him to still have it without sadness? There's always a one, and since you're dealing with the laws of nature, there's a one in a million chance, maybe a one in a billion, I don't know the odds, of such a thing happening that a person, everything he does immediately is successful without any type of problems or side problems that occur. You see? So therefore, the thing is that that's only, possibility. But if you go according to the laws of nature, probability, then a person will have what he calls sadness, all the troubles that come along with it. The rich person is righteous. We're saying the way he gets his money, and we're not saying it's impossible by chance that a person doesn't have problems, but if it is through, in other words, that is not a proof that he has divine providence. But if he has divine providence, and divine providence affects the way he makes a living, then that living will, the physical world will always fit into his plans for making money, and he'll make the money directly without all the complications that a person usually has in making money. What we want to give here is that the blessing of God means when you have wisdom and you get your money through wisdom, via wisdom, right? Okay. Now, there are a lot of business people that they make their money simply by force, like by constantly, they're really hard workers, and again, they make their money, sooner or later, right? But there are people that do, there might be businessmen that do think out, they might have a certain amount of thought. But that doesn't mean they have divine providence, because the way to get divine providence is not just thought in business, but it's thought about God himself, and this is just a particular case. But it is possible that a businessman can have thought, and he could work out deals based on thought, but he doesn't have control over factors outside his plan. And those factors, when they come in and interfere with his plan, he's going to have to deal with them. And he's going to have trouble dealing with it until he works out all these side effects, all these side problems that keep interfering. While the tzaddik is from the physical world outside. In other words, if you say that I make my money from wisdom, there are people that are thinkers that make money. You know, they thought it through. They worked it through. Right? So therefore, but yet they didn't have, they had the side effects. Here in Proverbs, this verse, is because the thing is that having divine providence is also a practical thing. In other words, we even show how if you reach the level where you have divine providence, so that that's a benefit, it's worth working for, because there is a benefit. Because the whole Proverbs is dealing with consequence and benefit for working for things. So the thing is here also, they show you the benefit. Saying divine providence is all or nothing. Divine providence is variation of degree. It depends on your relationship to God. There's a ratio between your relationship to God to God's relationship to you. Three ways in the way God relates to us. One, he relates to us through the laws of nature. Two, he relates to us. Now that works. Let's say, for instance, you have a computer, right? And you have a certain program, right? Now, let's say every time you hit a certain letter, there's in your program that a new program takes over, you see? And then there's a third way you could do things, that you could interfere with the program anytime you want. Okay, there are three ways of operating. There's a program that as soon as you put it on, you have a program. Then as soon as you hit a certain word or a certain form or something, then a totally new program bugs in. Okay? And then there's a third thing that you could interfere with the thing anytime you want. That is really the way God relates to us. There is a system called the laws of nature, okay, which we're familiar with. Then, if as you develop, there is a second system, which is called divine providence. Okay? It is a system that somehow that the physical world relates directly to you. Okay? Then there's a third way where God could suspend the systems at any point. That is called a miracle. That's the three ways which God relates to us. One is that they had a certain feeling that feels like somehow like Christianity, and I was trying to explain the difference between how religions in general work and Judaism work. Religions in general, what happens is that there's a certain insecurity with the physical world, and a person needs security, so it creates a God that relates and protects him personally. Okay, that is the purpose for the religion. But however, if you're looking for God via reality, via the physical world, then the first thing you come across is you're going to have to face reality. You're going to have to deal with reality. As you search for reality, you will find a second level of system where you will find that the system relates to you. You see? Now, the Torah is just here to show us what to look for when we go out there to search. But all that is a system that you have to recognize and learn and study it. But you cannot get to it until you accept reality for what it really is. And that's the study of what reality is. Creation of something to it's a fake security that I need, you know, because I can't take reality. The other one is a search for truth, and the Torah is telling us that if you truly search, what you will find. That you will find a system, that the system is it runs based on how you relate to God. There's one area in the physical world that you could see that, and that's the existence of the Jew. That's why the Jew has always been here, because he has divine the nation, the Jew. Because he has divine providence that it's impossible for him not to exist, but yet you find sometimes he's in terrible straits and sometimes in very good straits, and he keeps going back and forth. And that's because of, that's dependent. Cannot know the subject until you do an analysis of the opposites. At one time I had a question that all the commentaries, when they analyze the verse, they always analyze the opposites and they never tell you what the subject is. Is because the first step in the analysis is the opposites, is clarifying the opposites. Then once you clarify the opposites, then you can get the subject. That's why always our last question is what is the subject. Sometimes you could jump to a subject, but basically it's a clarification of the opposites, okay? Now the question is, what's the difference between advice and a command, okay?
Command implies that it's mandatory, whereas advice allows discretion by the hearer.
That is what you're saying. Then could you tell me what the subject is? Clarified the opposites. Now you can tell me what the subject is. Make the thing much clearer. Who is the decision maker? By a command, the person telling you is the decision maker. By advice, you're the decision maker. Couldn't have come to that subject of who is the decision maker until you clarified your clarification, what you said, the difference between advice and command. The same thing with all opposites, is the first thing must be analyzed, the opposites. And that's why I think that the commentaries always tell the differences in these verses and explain the opposites. 23. It is like a joke for the fool to do evil, or to do evil acts, and wisdom to the man of understanding. The question is the second half, doesn't, and wisdom to the man of understanding. What? It doesn't explain. There's like a word missing. The answer is the word joke from the first half of the sentence is also carried over to the second half. He does that many times. What he does is he says a word that fits into both halves of the sentence, and he leaves it out in the second half, and then you recognize to fill it in. So it's as a joke for the fool to do evil, and it is a joke to the man of understanding to do wisdom, or to do wise acts, or to live wisdom. Sometimes he doesn't finish the sentence, so the thing is, it must be someplace in the sentence how to finish it. So the word joke on the first half is carried over to the second. So it's a joke. It's as a joke to the fool to do evil acts, and it as a joke to a man of understanding to have wisdom, or to live the life of wisdom. In a sense, what does he mean by a joke? The problem is with the word a joke and how it fits into the verse. Okay, let's clarify that first. The word, many times in Proverbs, he has a word in the first sentence. And if you notice that the second sentence doesn't make any sense, so you carry out the word in the first verse, you carry it out to the second half of that verse. You see, from the first half of that verse to the second half of that verse. Like the word joke here. If you don't add the word joke, then it doesn't make sense, because it'll read something like this. It's like a joke to a fool to do evil, and wisdom to the man of understanding. And it doesn't explain what. Yeah, so the subject is missing. Therefore, what you must do is go back and find the subject of the first half, and they're saying the subject of the first half is like the subject of the second half, so therefore it reads like a joke to the fool to do to do evil acts, and it is like a joke, right, to do wisdom for the man of understanding. Now we have on the verses, what does it mean as a joke?
Sometimes a joke is something that you do non-seriously with a light-hearted attitude, without any great serious intent.
Adding to that, without any serious thought, and we're not talking about a professional comedian, but, you know, like the joke that people usually make in company, in a group, it comes out without much thought, in just a reaction to the to what somebody else is saying. Where does a joke, what's the source of a joke? Is that it's a habit. And we said, no, because we see many times children at a very young age have a sense of humor, you know, and it just comes naturally. They just pick it up. It's not a habit, but somehow they just pick it up. I that a joke stems someplace from our emotions. Someplace it just comes up from our emotions. It's a reaction to a certain situation, and it's like it's part of our emotions. You also notice that people have different types of jokes. Again, I'm not talking about like a comedian that plans his jokes. I'm talking about where a joke comes naturally in any given situation. You say, in that situation, it's just a reaction without thought. So if it's without thought or very little thought, that means it must come from the emotions. An unconscious statement. Unconscious reaction or a statement of the unconscious. The reason why you give a joke is for attention, okay? Now, it is true, maybe you want to get attention, but why did you give that particular joke at that particular time? Somebody else could have thought of a different type of joke at that particular situation, or the way they put it. Like sometimes somebody puts a joke in a more digging way. Some people make it more general. In other words, you have to see each person gives their joke in their own different way. So what they do say, whatever the motive is, whatever they do say, there is a certain amount, you must say there is a certain amount of truth that that person really holds, even though the person that's saying it doesn't realize it. Yes, the person you really hold this will say, I really don't mean this. I didn't mean that. And he really sincerely doesn't mean it, you know, consciously. But it did come out. It had to come from someplace. It came from him. It must be from him someplace. It has to be. Well, the question is that we want to start attaching this idea to the verse. The thing is that you have to be careful. The first thing must be 100% clear what a joke is. Then once you understand what a joke is, then you might be able to see how to apply it to the verse. But the first thing is total clarification of the subject, namely, right now the subject is joke, not the verse. Okay? We're just trying to understand what a joke is. That must be made perfectly clear first. After that, we could apply it to the verse. This is that I understand how, from this information, I understand the first half of the verse, that it's as a joke for the fool to do evil, means that it's an unconscious drive. There's just a desire to do evil. He didn't think it out and say that evil makes sense. He might plan evil, he might do logic to plan evil, but he never thought out evil itself. So therefore I could understand that it comes from his unconscious, right, to do evil.
Even based on his lifestyle.
Based on his decisions from childhood on, that he constantly followed his emotions, the decisions of his emotions, and it just kept developing that way until he could do evil. Like a person that steals and doesn't plan to murder, but if he steals a while, if he has to, he does. And then he becomes a murderer. So the thing is that I can understand. But on the other side, how is wisdom a joke to the man of understanding? What does that mean? The question is, it should be the same thing. What's the problem? And the answer, the question is that a man of understanding, the way he becomes understanding, he analyzes his basic framework in which he operates, and he has to undo the framework, the emotional framework in which he made decisions in his past. In other words, every human being, when they start out, they make basically emotional decisions. A child makes emotional decisions, unconscious decisions. That's the way it works. Then at a certain point where the mind is developed, then they start studying. 13, 14. Person gets involved in study. And then as he studies, he starts seeing that the way he's making decisions are incorrect. So therefore, from his mind, he starts undoing these emotions, and he starts making more decisions based on his mind until he's able to undo the emotion totally. Okay? This is the process, right? Okay. So what does it mean as a joke that he has wisdom as a joke? It doesn't come from the unconscious. It comes from the mind. It stems from the thought, the thinking out. Everything must be thought out.
If a joke is based on your unconscious, and the fool has built his unconscious up through a lifetime of incorrect decision-making, the man of understanding has done the opposite. He has spent his life building up a subconscious, making decisions based on correct principles. So, in the same sense, couldn't wisdom be a joke to him because it comes out of his subconscious, which is based on a lifetime of proper development and proper reasoning?
I think what you're saying is correct. I think it needs a little elaboration, okay? You see, the wicked person just continues from his childhood on acting in a certain way, and he keeps building on it, okay? What the righteous does is he starts undoing that decision-making part of him, of his emotions, okay, through his mind and analysis. What happens is that at a certain point his emotions fall in line with ideas. See? When his emotions fall in line with ideas, you see, so then it's emotional, you know what I mean? It's a natural thing. It's like it becomes what we call second nature for him to think rationally. His emotions are in line with that. His emotions desire that. So once your emotions desire that, then it becomes the most simplest thing in the world. Then it's as a joke. It comes naturally. Just like a joke comes naturally, so that the righteous person, his emotions accept that which is irrational and attaches to that which is irrational, and that he feels bad. Let's say, for instance, he does an irrational act. Now, he doesn't feel guilty like we feel guilty. We feel guilty because of society or because of the way we were raised. He feels guilty. His guilt attaches to the mind, and he feels guilty because it's irrational. So his emotions, even his guilt, is attached to the... is attached to rationale, you see? That's why it's a natural thing for him to do wisdom, you see?
He's saying that rationality or acting rationally is synonymous with acting morally and ethically.
See, whatever we do must be decided by reality. In other words, anything that's dictated to us via Torah, we see, must make sense. So therefore, when a thing makes sense, that makes it moral and ethical. That makes it right. If it makes sense, that makes it right. Okay? One of our sages said that I don't remember the two verses, but he quotes two verses. One verse says that you will be condemned for not following the other nations, and then another verse says you will be condemned for following them. So how is that possible? The answer is, if they say irrational things and you follow them, then you'll be condemned. They say rational things and you don't follow them, then you'll also be condemned. Is that your morality and your ethics and what is morals and ethics must be decided by the mind. This into halacha, into Jewish law, because Jewish law is a different subject. How that works is a separate problem. We could take that up as part of our discussion tape. Just Shirley is clarifying this, and she wants to say that a joke is something which is a response from the emotions. Okay? So the evil person, his response to everything is to do evil. While the righteous person, his natural emotional response, even though he got to it in a different way, you see, but his natural response is to do that which makes sense, to do rationale. Simply means the emotions, that it's a natural emotional thing. In other words, we're not taking joke literally. We're saying joke represents that which comes naturally from the emotions of a person. Is the word irrational, evil, and emotional synonymous? The answer is yes. Except with emotional, it's when emotions are making the decisions. Like if jealousy, vengeance are making decisions for you, then it's synonymous. However, if the emotions have turned to rationale, so then the emotions are okay. So a question in that is, what is the subject of the verse? With finding the subject here, is that the wicked make decisions. Their decision making factor is their emotions, their unconscious, like vengeance, greed. These are their decisions. And if they use rationale is used as a means of being successful in their endeavors. They have a plan, they work out a plan, but the plan is for the purpose of satisfying this emotion. However, the righteous, the decision-making factor, is the rationale, and the emotions are in line with those decisions and is in line with the thoughts of the ideas, you see. So the question is that they work like different angles, the emotions. Yet somehow the subject seems to be the emotions. You see what I mean? So the question is, what is the subject here? Clarify the question. In other words, one is the decision-making factor, and one attaches to, in other words, by the wicked, it's the decision-making factor of the emotions. It just keeps getting worse, that's all. But the thing is that by the tzaddik, the emotions attach to the decision-making factor, namely the mind. This way, when a person starts out doing evil, so he has a certain conflict, because he has a certain amount of, usually they have a certain amount they raise in the society, and they have a certain value of the society. So there's a certain conflict of doing evil. Same thing with doing rationale. If you want to live a good life, so there's a certain part of you that wants to go the other way. You see? Now the thing is that slowly but surely, whichever way you go, see, free will, let's put it this way, free will starts out about even when you start out. But after you start making decisions in a certain way, so that side becomes stronger and stronger until the emotion becomes, until your whole personality becomes evil or your whole personality becomes righteous. You see, it's a total picture of the personality, you see. In other words, see, most people never reach either level. Most people are always caught in their conflicts. And therefore, we're not dealing with that type of person. What we're dealing with is a person that started making decisions in evil, and slowly but surely he gave up any moral controls over his decisions, and it doesn't bother him at all to do evil. There's no conflict in doing evil. His conflict is where his evil is not successful. But however, the righteous go the opposite way, where they start giving up all parts of evil, where their total being become righteous. You see? And that becomes the nature of the person. You see, it becomes totally his nature. That, in other words, most people are in conflict. They move a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left, you know, like some people move a little bit more towards righteousness, some people move a little more towards evil, but however, it's not complete. They're caught in their conflicts and they don't move to any direction. But however, a real wicked person, a fool, a person that really goes all the way, so then his total being is that way. So therefore, what we're talking about is that it becomes like a joke. It means it becomes his nature. There's two natures. In other words, when a person starts out, let's call it mediocrity, he's in between, he has this or that. Some people stay that way more or less. But the thing is that the personality becomes either totally evil or totally good. You see, if they start really making their moves in the different directions. So therefore, we're talking about there's two natures. In other words, we're defining that there's two types of nature. One nature is evil, that it's natural to be evil, and one nature is it's natural to be righteous, or to be rational, to live the life of wisdom. All right, we're talking about the building, in other words, the result of the direction in which you go. If you go in one direction and you're totally evil, evil becomes the easiest thing in the world for you. It's natural, you have no conflict with evil. And if you go in the world of righteousness, then you have no conflict with righteousness, and it's the easiest thing in the world. It's as easy as a joke. It's a second nature to you. You see? Proverbs chapter 29, verse 7. And it says that the righteous know the law of the poor. Law spelled L-A-W. And the wicked do not understand knowledge. What's the law of the poor? Another question is what does it mean they don't understand knowledge? And you say they don't have knowledge. What do you mean they don't understand knowledge? What does that mean? There are a lot of wicked people that have intelligence and understand a lot of things. You know what I mean? What does it mean they don't understand knowledge? And two, the first half of the verse says that the righteous know the law of the poor. So the second half should say that the wicked don't know the law of the poor. What does one thing have to do with another? I mean, he knows the law of the poor, and he doesn't have any knowledge. I mean, what is it talking about? Okay? The question that we'll deal with is the wicked understand. What does it mean, understanding knowledge? That we're dealing with the question is that the wicked do not understand knowledge, and there's a first step taken is that somehow they have some knowledge that they don't understand it. Some knowledge, but they don't understand what they have somehow. Well, I mean, but it's a good first step. At least it gives us a guide, even though it's not finished. There is a science. By knowledge, it means science, okay? There's science, there's physics, there's chemistry, a lot of different sciences. But however, like for instance, I understand that some people wrote a book like The Philosophy I've written a philosophy on Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, what that means is like this. They have a science, and then they say, now this information, how does it affect me personally? You see? Okay? Now, a lot of people have a particular science, but they don't see how to interpret it and put it in terms of a philosophy of life. What does it mean? You see? What they have is basically, what they have is that they have a certain science, but their way of life comes from their personal emotions, but it's not based on any knowledge. It's not based on any knowledge. Well, let's put it this way. Years ago, they had in the time of FDR, there was a problem that people were very poor, right? So he came out with a system that helping, what was the name? The New Deal, right. Which helped the poor, but the terrible, terrible consequences that we're paying today as a result of that, right? Okay. And also, then we started helping a lot of different poor. I mean, there were different, and then later on we helped the blacks, and now we're trying a whole new thing, right? Right? Right. Now, the thing is what they're looking at is they look at the problem, and then they say, well, let's remove the problem. But they don't have a total picture of the whole problem. In other words, okay, we'll get in a little clearer in that. In other words, they have particular sciences. They know the science of a new deal, you know, how to work out a system to get money to the poor, right? And we'll make up a system, whether a good system or not a good system, but we don't see a total picture. We're only looking at a particular science, you see? Or, for instance, I one time read a mathematician who says, if everybody studied mathematics, there'd be peace in this world. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, everybody looks at the world from their own point of view. Like they say, like if three people walk into a synagogue, so a painter will say, boy, look at the painting, it's a beautiful paint. The carpenter will say, boy, look at the carpentry, beautiful carpentry, you know. Each person looks at the world from their point of view, right? But so the mathematician has science, he looks at the world with, you know, psychiatrist has knowledge, he says, oh, we'll cure the world through psychology, and this one has knowledge. They don't have a total picture. You see, they don't, the means of that total picture is really a philosophy based on reality, based on science. It's abstracted from science, and that is what the Torah really helps us to do. Okay? The Torah really guides us, okay, towards this type of thinking so that you build the philosophy based on science. That is understanding. See, understanding itself is a science, but it's a science built on science. In fact, the knowledge of God is called metaphysics, because you take physics, and building on the science of physics, you get more information beyond the mere facts. That is a certain training how to do that. Most people are caught in their particular world, in their particular science, and they see everything from their science. Okay? Is that clear? So therefore, understanding knowledge means by taking scientific knowledge and making a philosophy out of it, which is itself is a science, must be worked scientifically. In other words, it's not just a certain feeling, but you must show step by step that this philosophy of life is based on truth and reality. See, knowledge means science. They have a science, but they don't know how to interpret that science in their own life. When FDR made a New Deal, it just sounded good to him. You know what I mean? We'll feed the poor. Okay? That was it. You know what I mean? But where did he get it from? Well, maybe we shouldn't feed the poor. Maybe we should do something else. Mr. Clinton wants to give him jobs. Say, look, I'll feed you for 2 years, then learn a job. Is that the answer? I don't know, you see. But he's only looking at, he has a particular problem, he has a particular answer. Is it based on a philosophy of life or a proof? Could he prove it that this is the right answer? You see? And he just came up with an answer. This sounds good. Yeah, well, it's true. It's a good idea. We'll train him a job. It's fine. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? Does it really work? Where does he get it from? And the law of the poor, so Rashi says that the tzaddik knows his pain, his needs, and how to give him heart. By heart meaning, like, because when you're poor, it breaks you. So to build that confidence, build confidence in a person. That's what Rashi says, what it means to know the law of the poor. So how is Rashi learning the law of the poor? The Rashi says that the righteous know the pain of the poor, the needs of the poor, and to give them confidence. That's how he explains the law of the poor. So what does, according to Rashi, what does the verse mean? Law of the poor. We had a question before. What does it mean, the law of the poor? Rashi is explaining it with these three things, what the tzaddik knows. So how would you define the word law, according to Rashi? Saying that the law of the poor is using it like a law of physics. It's a principle in which there's a certain system, the way poor operate. You see? It's a system that in general, just like we have a law of gravity, the law, you understand, different. It's a different system. It's a certain system, you see? Now that system, as you notice from the three things that Rashi said, it's three different subjects. First of all, he recognizes certain pain that he's in, right? That's one area. That's more, right? That's more of an area of an understanding, to try and help, you know, ease the pain. Needs, well, we'd have to teach him a profession, we'd have to teach him a craft, so something to do. And encouragement, I mean, to build his confidence, you'd have to be a psychiatrist, you see? So the thing is that, you see, by a law of the poor, if it's because he has the knowledge of an overall view of life based on abstracting, either he could get it from Torah or by understanding science and then abstracting from science a way of life, he knows the needs of a human being. In other words, like this. There are poor people. Should we give them money? Well, you have to understand that then that's only looking at it from one way, like the New Deal, right? But I'm not looking at his confidence. If you give a poor person money, then sometimes you break his confidence. Another person, you know, you have to give him money because of other reasons that you won't affect this guy. You have to know all the aspects of this person. He has an overall view of the total person from all aspects. While the New Deal only looks at that he doesn't have money, so I'll give him money. You understand? That's looking at it objectively. You understand? But not from the nature of the person. Not from the real needs of the person. It's a very one aspect look at the person, just from his angle. Now, they're missing money, so I'll give them money. Right? Now, today they're complaining a lot of people are living off welfare, and they're cheating on welfare, so we'll only keep them on welfare. But did you analyze the nature of these people? Maybe that's not the answer. Maybe have to deal with their personality. Maybe they need an education about life altogether. You know what I mean? Like Proverbs, like we're getting here. I don't know what their needs are. You have to know the law of the poor. The nature, in other words, what's their nature? You can't just look at it from an outside, like, well, I see they don't have money, I'll give them money. Not everybody, that's the answer. Not for everybody is that the answer. You have to know the nature of the law of the poor, you see, to know exactly all aspects, what their needs are, their pain, and their confidence. You see, you have to know the whole picture. And is, so, the two sides of the verse. In other words, the tzaddik has knowledge of this law, the system of the poor, and the wicked don't have this knowledge. In other words, they might have knowledge, they might have science, but they don't understand how to deal with the total picture. That only you train via Torah, and you trained via the knowing how to interpret science to turn it into a philosophy of life, to know what's necessary, you see? But the thing is, the wicked don't have this, right? Okay. So the question is, what is the subject of the verse? What's the subject? The point made was that the second half of the verse, the wicked, do not have a system of how to live. They have science, but but they do not live by any system, but in their personal life, and their personal decisions are not made by any system. But when we say wicked here, we're not talking about a Nazi, okay? We're talking about a person that's kind and wants to help a poor person. In other words, that has to be that we see from the first half of the verse that we're talking about how to help a poor person. Okay? So, okay? I could hear, it is not that he's not doing it for selfish reasons. We're not talking about that in this verse. Does not mention that there underneath it is a self. It might be that he does have a selfish purpose. But however, the wicked person here is really helping. Really wants to help. Is that there's two ways in helping the poor. Okay? Two people have a desire to help the poor. One has knowledge. He has scientific knowledge, but he doesn't have a method of life, like in sometimes the verse it says the tree of life, right, or a path of life, a way of life, a philosophy of life. They don't have an overall view of all aspects what is necessary to live, so therefore they can't help another person. If you don't have a philosophy of life, a true philosophy of life, let's put it this way, and you try to help somebody else, then you're wicked by definition. Why are you wicked? What is a wicked person? Somebody that harms other people. Right? Now, if you don't have the correct philosophy of life and you try to help somebody, then you're not going to take all these aspects, like, for instance, like Rashi says, that you have to know what his pain is, what his conflicts are, what it bothers him. You have to know his physical needs. And you have to know that there's lack of confidence and how it broke him. And you have to take all three into consideration when you make the decision how to help this person. Now, if you don't take all these three in consideration, then you're going to do harm. Let's say, for instance, that the FDR, let's say, I don't know the situation at the time, let's say what the people needed was confidence and they should have been it should have been done a different way, a whole picture of life, a whole different picture. They needed a different type of guidance. So therefore, all is help because there could be terrible consequences, and maybe we're paying the consequences. I didn't follow through step by step. You know, the New Deal brought about consequences. There was any trouble with it. But I'm trying to show you that it's only a very narrow view of life. And if you try to help somebody with a narrow view of life, you are evil because you're going to destroy them. You can, according to Proverbs, you can't say, well, I had my heart in the right place. That doesn't help. You are evil. Okay? And therefore, a person has to know when he's ready to help another person and when he is not. And to help another person, you must know the law of the poor. By meaning, you must know a person that's broken, person that needs help, you have to know how the system works. It's a system, and you have to understand all aspects, and you have to take that all into consideration in your dealings with that person. Good deal for any particular reason, it just happened to pop into my mind. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm not saying I'm not making any decision. I'm only saying that that it's only taking in consideration one part of the thing. But it was a very good thing. I don't know. I mean, you'd have to do a real analysis to really see. But I'm not picking on it. The question is, why did the second half of the verse say that they don't understand knowledge? It should say that they don't understand the law of the poor. What they wanted to get across is that they don't have understanding. That's why they don't know the law of the poor. They don't have an overall philosophy of life. You have to have an overall philosophy of life. You have to know who God is. I mean, who is man in general. You have to have a knowledge of a human in general to know the particular of a person's needs. Okay? The reason why, in other words, the person has a real desire to help. You see, we're talking about a person that has a real desire to help another person. It's a sincere desire. You see? But however, what he is lacking is an overall philosophy of life and about how to
a philosophy of life, which means he has to know who is a human, where is his place in the universe, what is his relationship to God, all these aspects. Then he must have all the sciences. He must know how to get all the different possible jobs in case he has to help him out with his needs. He has to know that area of science. He also has to know the science of psychology. He has to know all different types of areas and to know all this overview of a philosophy of life before he can make a decision of how to help a person. A practical question. Let's say you have a person that's kind, but they're still ignorant. I mean, should you take away their kindness? That also would be wrong, you see. In other words, when Proverbs says that a person is wicked, you have to understand his definition of wicked is ignorance. Now, anybody that starts off, every human being is ignorant of this knowledge, and therefore we're all wicked, according to Proverbs, and he's right. But however, you cannot take away a person's kindness, and you have to sometimes let his kindness go, even in an incorrect manner, to keep that kindness awake. But however, the person in the meantime should develop his knowledge so that his kindness will be tempered by knowledge. But however, if a person develops without knowledge and this kindness continues, the harm can be catastrophic at times, because they're going to make decisions that could be very harmful to the people that they're dealing with and to the world at large.